Yeah, I'm locked down. My world's a prison, confined only by the state of mind I live in, infatuated with women and all this money I'm getting. I'm trapped by this rock star lifestyle I'm living.
I'm trapped.
Yeah, it's got me thinking like I need another.
So
they say love is blind, we can't see each other. I'm addicted to these girls, my bad habit. You can keep your heart, yeah,
and
you can
I
have it.
Listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and we're live with What Pink Sounds Like. I've got a great show for you today. I'm interviewing Kathy Stonehouse, which is the author of Something About the Animal, an excellent collection of short fiction. Also in the program, we're going to be doing a concert review about the Janelle Monáe show that just happened at Rogers Arena here in Vancouver. So lots and lots and lots on the program. If you're just tuning in or you're a regular fan of this show, you would know that I've been gone for 2 weeks. My voice is a bit hoarse, and I blame that on the wedding I was at. I was a bridesmaid for the first time, so I'll talk about some funny stories about that as well in the show. But on with it, we've got lots to cover, so let's get started right away. We're going to start the show off right. Here's Mother Mother off their latest album, Eureka.
We'll be right back.
As I lose my mind, reminded by things I find, like notes and clothes you've left behind. Wake me up when all is done. I won't rise until this battle's won. My dignity's become undone, but I won't go. I can't do it on my own. If this ain't love, then what is? I'm willing to take the risk. I won't go. I can't do it on my own. If this ain't love, then what is? I'm willing to take the risk. So petrified, I'm so scared to step into this ride. What if I lose my heart and fail the climb? I won't forgive me if I give up trying. I heard his voice today. I didn't know a single word he said. Now I'm resemblance to the man I met. Just a vague and broken boy instead. But I won't go. I can't do it on my own. If this ain't love, then what is? I'm willing to take the risk. I won't go.
Welcome back. You're listening to What Pink Sounds Like here on CITR 101.9 FM here in Vancouver. I'm your host, Ashley Kissman. And as I said before, that lovely musical interlude of Mother, Mother, and Adele, that today on the program, I'm interviewing SFU writing instructor and author Kathy Stonehouse on her new collection of short fiction called Something About the Animal. It was recently published by Biblioasis, and the stories are great. They're horrifyingly funny and addicting, and I just have to say that I've thoroughly enjoyed reading them. I think Kathy is able to do what many writers find very difficult by writing about very dark topics like child abuse, PTSD, and death, but making them amusing, bearable, and interesting to readers. And Kathy now joins me in the studio. Welcome, Kathy.
Hi, Ashley. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with me. So I just want to tell our readers a bit more about you. You're originally from the UK, but you moved to Vancouver after receiving a BA in English from Oxford University and completed a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from UBC, right here on the very campus we're broadcasting from. Now, you've done, you've authored quite a bit so far. You were formerly the editor of Event Magazine, and you've wrote many books, one about poetry called The Words I Know, and then also a creative nonfiction anthology with a couple of other authors called Double Lives, Writing, and Motherhood. So what made you decide to write a book about short fiction? What made you decide to tackle this genre?
Well, I think I've really always wanted to write fiction. And when I moved to Vancouver, I actually, when I was doing my MFA, I did take a fantastic fiction workshop with instructor Linda Svensson, and I really enjoyed it. But I think my problem at that time was, you know, I just arrived from the UK, and I felt like my whole frame of reference and my language was so different from where, from my surroundings, that it was almost, it was like culturally quite difficult for me to write in prose. I found it easier to write poetry. But, you know, I've always been thinking about fiction and trying to write fiction. And then when I was editing Event, I read a lot of short fiction, and I really felt like, okay, this is, I really need to start doing this, because it's, you know, it's been in me for so long. And once I got going on it, I feel like short fiction actually has a lot in common with poetry, because there's a lot of unsaid or the kind of things that are implied, because you can't explain everything in a short story. There's always a lot that's left to the reader's imagination. And so I feel that that's actually strangely similar to poetry. And also there's a lot of strong imagery often in stories. And so in fact, it didn't seem like as much of a leap as it might seem from the outside. You know, just a difference in terms of you know, the form of the writing and everything, but there was enough in common that it felt very much like my home, actually, when I started writing the stories.
I mean, that is really interesting, because I think you make a good point in that poetry and short fiction do share quite a bit, because with short fiction, you can't start from the very origin of the story like a novel or something. You kind of have to go right in the middle.
It's almost like a slice out of the middle of a story, and everything that came before and everything that came after is has to be imagined. And in some ways, I really like the power of that, because it makes this little slice in the middle, every single thing about it is kind of really significant, and so there's a lot of space around it. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
So, I mean, what do you love about the genre of short fiction in particular over maybe poetry or creative nonfiction?
Well, I'd have to say that one thing I love about short fiction is that it's short, because I find, you know, as a mother, when I, you know, first became a mom, and I mean, I'm quite an addicted reader, and it was really hard to not be able to read so much, and I just found that my fragmented attention span worked so much better with short stories. And but the funny thing about short stories is, just because they don't take long to read, it doesn't mean that they don't live a long time in your imagination. And I found that, strangely enough, stories would make a huge impact on me and stay with me in a way that some novels wouldn't. And so I think that there's a kind of power to short fiction that's belied by its length. And also, it's just it's a very, very Canadian form, if I may say so. I mean, Canada has spawned a lot of amazing short story writers, and I really appreciate that tradition. And I've been very inspired by a lot, especially the women, the female short story writers of Canada. And I think it's a wonderful form. It has a lot to offer, and everybody's always trying to suggest that, you know, the novel is really more serious. But I feel like, meh, you know, I think a good short story can face down a good novel, you know, if it's well written.
Totally. Yeah. And like you said, it really sticks with you. And a lot of your stories, I have to say, will stick with me, I think, long after this interview is over. And I mean, as we discussed in Something About the Animal, there's a lot of dark themes and complex characters and complex storylines where you as the reader must really read in between the lines to figure out what is really going on. And of course, with these several different stories or numerous stories in the book, there's different characters, some humans, some not human even, and it's all about interpreting them. Some of the dark themes we talked about were PTSD, child abuse, postpartum depression, even one about suicide, homicide, mental illness. Where did you get the inspiration to tackle these dark topics? Is this something that's always been kind of in your framework, or was this something very new for you?
Well, I think there's something about short fiction that it's almost like putting, I feel like it's putting language under pressure, and I like to, I found that there's a kind of pressure, an emotional pressure that builds up in the language, and often it sort of teeters between humor and horror in a certain way, and I just felt that a lot of these topics are things that it's very difficult to talk about and maybe in a way remain quite unarticulated in our society. And so in some ways, the form seemed to suit it, because it was about trying to talk about something that was unspeakable in a certain way, but in this form that leaves a lot unsaid. And I think that, you know, I guess I've always been interested work that really pushes the extremes in a certain way. You know, a lot of the writers that I like to read also have that. I guess it's maybe a reaction against writing that's very kind of... I think there's just been a lot of fiction that's covered, you know, a lot of kind of very familiar, perhaps slightly blander topics in a certain way, and for some reason that just isn't where I wanted to go. And so the stories took on a certain momentum, and also because there's a kind of absurdity and surreal kind of bizarreness often to life lived at the extremes, and that just seemed to start becoming the tone as the story started to accumulate. So yeah, it's certainly very, I think it does put a lot of demands on the reader, but that's why I think just a little chunk. That's why they're just little slices. Yeah. It's like a dense piece of cake, you know. You don't want to have too much, but you can, you know, it packs a lot into a small space. Yeah,
it does. And yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head with bizarreness, because in no way, I want to let our listeners know, in no way are these stories depressing. Like, I never felt depressed while reading it, even though there are some very dark topics. But really, it does take you to this bizarre plane in our universe of human thought and human emotions that maybe you as a reader have never personally experienced, but by reading it through the, you know, eyes and ears of the characters, you really start to feel the weirdness of the situation and weirdness of human experience. So yeah, I would totally agree. Going along with weirdness, this is a nice segue into this. There are many stories that are told from the point of view of humans, but there's one story in particular called Child Abuse. And in it, it's almost not necessarily about child abuse, but perhaps an abuse about a dog, a talking dog.
That's right. Mitzi, yes. One of my favorite characters. Yes. Well, yeah, in some ways I feel like that story is kind of central, because I realized as the stories came together that in a way partly what I was talking about was the bizarre reality of being human, where we have these very rational brains and we think we understand everything and that we're very mentally in control, but we're also these physical beings that have all these kind of drives and appetites and urges and behaviors and things that we can't control, which are very physiological. So we're animals, even though we would prefer not to be. And I think that that's one of the weird things about modern culture, is how we have lost touch with our animal natures or our sort of mortal selves. And so I got the idea for Mitzi just through, I mean, in Vancouver, you know, there's a lot of people who have dogs instead of children, I think. You know, there's a lot of dog, just the clothes for dogs, the food for dogs, and yeah. There was just something so bizarre about this. And I just felt like I had to explore that. So Mitzi is basically a dog who's being subjected to this incredible amount of attention and pressure to perform, which I think is the way we often treat our children as well these days, because we're having fewer and fewer children, and so there's all this pressure that's put on kids to perform and fulfill their parents' needs. And so the idea of laying that on a dog just seemed... anyway, it was a fascinating idea. So then Mitzi just... And then I wasn't expecting her to actually have a voice, but then she started to talk, and I was like, okay. So, yeah, I in that way, I feel like the story really encapsulates a lot of the themes of the book, yeah.
It does. Yeah. And is that how you choose to write? Do you usually start writing and then allow the characters to take on kind of personas and lives of their own? Does that happen more often than not when you write?
Absolutely. You know, I tend to have an idea. And, you know, usually the idea, something of the idea remains, but really what happens is it's just something to get me going. And once I get going, then I find that the story often takes a very different direction. And it's often mostly to do with voice. Like, I feel like a voice starts to inhabit me or inhabit the page. And it can be the voice of the character, or it can be a certain tone. And then that's what takes off. So a lot of these characters really came to me really through their language and their voice. And it's quite often surprising to me. I never quite know where it's going to end up. So it's a very experiential process for me. It's not something that I like to pretend I can plan it out, but it never really never goes
never
according to plan.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes some of the best masterpieces come out when it's not, in fact, planned. I have one question that I think, I mean, I'm not necessarily a creative writer, but I would imagine that it would be very hard to add humor to dark topics. How do you go about adding humor to these dark stories?
I'm not sure that I add it really as I make space for it to emerge. I actually think that a lot of seemingly terrible experiences are actually very funny, not least because I think laughing and crying are very connected in our bodies, and often you know, I think a lot of people have known that in history, like clowns and you know, you think about when people do tell jokes and things, often they are very, very sort of edgy. And I think there's a kind of strange place where those experiences come together. And also, it's very liberating to laugh about things and put them in perspective. So I find that actually the humor just tends to emerge from the situation. It just starts to appear funny. And there's something about allowing all of that to be there at the same time that brings a life to the work, you know. So yeah, it's not, I guess I just like to laugh as well, and I realized that I couldn't make funny poetry, which is one of the reasons I've decided to write fiction, because I wanted to be able to make people laugh, because it's such a great experience to be able to do that, you know. And so yeah, that's I'm very glad that people have said yes, they did. I did laugh. I did find that funny, and that's very gratifying. Yeah.
In your opening story, Beryl takes a knife. This story really sucked me in, and I think it was a really great story to put first, and something about the animal. It really reminded me of a story I read in university called The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. I'm sure a lot of university students may remember this story. It might be fresh in their mind. If you're not, the story is told from the perspective of a woman, and as the first-person perspective, and as you're reading it, you start to realize and you start to question the sanity of, in fact, the narrator. And you start to realize that the world around her may be only her perception of it in her state of mental illness, which, of course, you don't really realize until further reading it. And then it really makes you question what you've perceived as the reader when you're reading it from her perspective. Why did you decide to start with this story?
That was a really powerful writing experience because I really wasn't sure, you know, when I started writing that story, quite what was real for Beryl. And but there's, I think that's another theme that runs through the book, is the kinds of delusions that we hold on to, that to avoid, kind of in a way of self-protective means of trying to shield ourselves from things that are painful, that we often walk around with incredible delusions that we're convinced are real. And some people get considered crazy, but there's a lot of us that also have quite strong delusions that may not come under that category. And so I wanted the reader to have that experience of moving further and further and further and realizing that things are warping, and suddenly it's really, you know, there's a whole twist happening and you're not quite sure what's real and what's not, and realizing that inside her world it has this amazing logic, but it is actually kind of a crazy logic. So there's definitely something about that, as they say, unreliable narrator that I really love when I read a story and I feel like the ground's being taken out from under my feet. And I wanted to create that experience for the reader. And I guess I started the book with it because I felt like it was kind of a microcosm of the experience the reader might have as they went on through the book. Yeah.
Yeah, there were also some feminist themes in the stories that I picked up, and this could be from my own background of loving to dissect literature as a woman's studies student back in my student days. For example, in your stories going to India, that's a powerful story that we were talking about before we turned the mics on about postpartum depression. The vulnerability of women in particular, I find, is evident also in the Stockholm Syndrome, which was quite powerful, about a girl and an abusive a series of abusive relationships with her boyfriends, kind of one after the other. Was that an intentional theme you wanted to portray in some of these stories, or did that come about as the result of the characters?
Well, I wouldn't say I set out to write necessarily feminist stories, but I am a feminist, and I was been very involved in earlier years in different women's organizations, and it's just, I guess, part of my worldview, and wanting to reveal the situations that women can find themselves in that may look from the outside like experience of being a quote victim or being sort of, you know, having a tragic situation, but wanting to look at that from the inside and look at how and why that comes about, and the dignity and the sort of the mental processes that go into somebody when they're in that kind of situation, and also looking at the power dynamics that go on. And certainly with going to India, I just wanted to expose that experience of new motherhood, which can be incredibly wrenching and isolating for some women, especially if you're a single mother and you don't have a lot of supports. And just the kind of, I mean, in that story, the character has a lot of different escape routes that she takes, you know, both physical and mental. It's really about, I mean, the idea of going to India is really like basically living a fantasy life. I mean, that's really what she's doing, but it doesn't work for her. She can't escape what's going on. There is a feminist theme or a kind of examination of that for sure. Yeah. Maybe in a complex way, not in a simple way, but it's definitely a recurrent theme. Yeah. So you were not imagining it. It was really in there.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm not as rusty as I thought in my literary analysis. Great. So what we'll do now, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to What Pink Sounds Like on CITR 101.9 FM. I have the lovely pleasure of having Kathy Stonehouse in this studio. She is the author of the latest book, Something About the Animal, a collection of short fiction. We'll take a short musical break, and when we come back, she will read a short little excerpt of her book for all you listeners, so you get a real taste of what we're talking about here on today's show. But stay tuned. Here up right now is Hannah Gorgas with Bang Bang You're Dead.
Bang Bang You're Dead!
And that was Hannah Gorgas with Bang Bang You're Dead, always a favorite musician that we like here on What Pink Sounds Like. If you're just tuning in, I'm your host, Ashley Kissman. I have in studio author Kathy Stonehouse, who just completed and published her first short fiction collection of stories called Something About the Animal. And it's been a pleasure to talk to her today. She's an instructor at SFU for creative writing, and she also does some work at Langara College, correct?
That's right.
Some students.
Yeah.
Great. So before she gives us a very tasty excerpt of one of the stories in her book, which I'm very excited to share with you listeners today, I want to ask about the title. So the title is Something About the Animal. It has a half horse, half woman on the front looking into a bathroom mirror. What is the animal? How did you come up with this title?
Well, titles are tough, you know, and I had a few titles that were kind of in my mind, but the title actually comes from the last story in the book. It became the title of the story and eventually seemed like it fit the whole book, and it's kind of a throwaway line in the story. The story is about a young girl who kind of befriends a horse and then gets to know this young boy whose family owns the horse, and she's having a hard time in her life, and he appears to be very privileged, but she begins to realize that there's more going on in his life than she can understand. And and there's something that the animal is refers to the horses that the boy keeps, and the effect that the horses have on people. And I think it just struck me as the right title because, in a way, the animal is the human animal, I guess. And it's really about something that's hard to define about the human animal, but really perhaps the paradox of being human and animal. So that's why I was just thrilled when Dan Biblioasis suggested this cover, which is a photograph by, now let me see if I get her name right, Gabrielle Nouveau, and she's a Montreal photographer. And when he sent me this picture, I just knew it was like so right for the book, you know, because it's a half animal, half person, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a strange disconnect between the person in the mirror and the person looking in the mirror, which fits the kind of skewed perspective of the book. So, so that really kind of came together, yeah.
Now, what advice do you give to your students about writing?
Well, a lot of different things. You know, I think the thing that I always feel is there's good news and bad news about writing. You know, I love teaching writing, and I love the excitement that people feel and the thrill when they realize the wonderful things you can do with language and with writing. But the bad news is often, it's really hard. Like, there's a lot of work that goes into it, and I think it's often hard to understand that until you really get involved in the process. And I think really it's really about sticking with it and putting in the work, and that it does pay off, but it's not an easy process. So, sticking with it and sticking to your own vision, even if it doesn't seem to match what people around you want, and understanding how to take on feedback in a useful way, but also to not take on feedback if it's actually not helpful, which is a very difficult technique to figure out, you know, because if you just write what everybody else wants you to write, then you lose your own integrity. So something in the middle there, which is not something I'm still working on myself, but mostly just to keep with it and also to keep reading, that reading feeds writing. And it may seem obvious, but sometimes people don't make that connection.
They might forget.
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. So yeah, read a lot. Yeah, that's probably the best.
So you're now going to read a passage of one of the stories. Can you tell us what the story is called?
Well, I'm going to read, we were just chatting in the break, you know, I'm like, oh, gee, there's so many things I want to read. but, you know, when you talked about the first story, Beryl Takes a Knife, I did feel like I'd like to read a piece of that. And it was a really good suggestion to find something from the middle where things start to go a little wonky for Beryl, or at least for the reader. So I'm going to read a section in the middle, and maybe just to set it up for the readers. We've been sitting with Beryl. She's making a model village. So that's her sort of hobby or obsession, is making a miniature landscapes. And she's also agoraphobic, so she doesn't like to go outside, and her husband recently left her because she doesn't seem to want to deal with this. But there's all kinds of inner truths that are emerging as it's told in her voice. So I'm going to start in where in her point of view, and she's still thinking about her husband and also her uncle Stuart, who it emerges actually, or it appears to emerge, may have raped her when she was a young girl, and that this experience is coming back to haunt her now. In fact, she's even convinced that he's actually coming to visit her.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably all you need to know, at least for now. Okay, so this is from Beryl Takes a Knife. Thinking of it now, one of the main reasons she married Derek was because he could disappear in a crowd. Unassuming and average, he made space available for her to be special, just stayed still and held her gaze until suddenly everything she did became interesting. He also didn't mind screwing in the dark. The built-in wardrobe had had a light, a naked bulb that polished Uncle Stu's head into an angry planet, and Beryl didn't want to examine it too closely in case she, too, suddenly went into orbit. Derek kindly closed the curtains and put the doorstop under the door, which Beryl enjoyed because it meant she didn't have to wear makeup and also she could cry without her husband noticing. When Dr. McVitie examined her once and asked if she'd ever had a baby, she slammed her legs together, accidentally kicking him in the face. There was nothing she could do. She was simply infertile. The birth control pills went secretly into her jewelry box, popped out of their blister packs, intermingled with loose beads, a month's worth of privacy at a time. "Uncle Stuart, is that you?" No answer. After June's letter arrived, she started scanning phone books. It had been 30 years, but the name of Stuart's company was burned into her consciousness. Step Right Up Elevated Shoes Incorporated. After Beryl's mother had thrown Stu out, not for impregnating Beryl, but for spitting out her beef stroganoff, her ex-stepfather had risen rapidly up the corporate ladder and eventually taken over the company. When Beryl called Uncle Stuart, she would have to mention this, but all in good time, as her mother would say. "Beryl, my love, how are you? How's your mother? Still making that lasagna?" "She's dead, Stu. She died 10 years ago." "Oh, dear, what a shame. Lovely lady still. Time is money, as they say, and I am at work, so what can I do you for? I wondered if you'd like to meet me." "Meet you? Of course I would. The trouble is, I'm off to L.A. in 3 weeks. I've got a chauffeur now, fleet of cars. What's it about, anyway?" "It's to do with my mother." "Oh, left me a fortune, did she?" "She took some photographs." The line goes dead for a moment, while Uncle Stu regains his composure. All right, don't get your knickers in a twist. How much do you want?" "It's not about cash, Mr. Harley. I want to see you." After some negotiating, Stuart agrees to pop over after dark one evening, just for a few minutes, provided Beryl can guarantee that she'll be alone. They agree on this Thursday, 10:30 p.m. Beryl approaches the front door with trepidation. Should she limp? Perhaps if he asks, she can say she's having a good day or that her scooter is parked out the back. Hopefully, he just won't notice. Meanwhile, there may be a grandchild with him. What if he or she looks like the boy? And what will happen when Uncle Stu sees her, middle-aged now, with poor posture and badly dyed hair, nothing like the willowy schoolchild, glossy and tightly braided pigtails who opened her bedroom door that early evening and welcomed him in with a flash of her braces, her leg? He'd never looked at her before or since, barely seemed to notice until she slipped her socks off. It was true she had been jealous of her mother, hated her really, had wanted to prove she existed, but this was hardly what she had intended, being swooped upon, led by her elbow into the closet where her Cindy doll had only last night received a pencil tattoo, noticing how aroused she was by Uncle Stu's caresses, his dear dears and their theirs culminating in an excruciating coitus during which she roasted on a spit. Oh, it was hot in there, in here, the sun once again far too close, the linoleum beneath her feet like tarmac turned sticky as the good doctor cut the cord and handed him to her, Uncle Stu in miniature, rooting for her breast, latching on with razor-sharp gums. Maybe I'll leave it there.
Excellent. Yeah, excellent. And that is the first story in Something About the Animal by Kathy Stonehouse. Powerful, powerful story where you really start to see what is going on with this character and where she's taking the story and where she's taking the reader.
Yeah, for sure. It's quite a ride. Yes.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining me in studio today. Always a pleasure. And where can listeners get the book?
Well, thanks a lot, Ashley. It's been great to be here. You can get the book actually here on campus at the UBC bookstore. I just checked today. You can also get it at People's Co-op on Commercial Drive and various other bookstores around the Lower Mainland. And you can always ask them to order it. It's published by Biblioasis Press, based in Ontario. And also, I have a website, www.kathystonehouse.com, so you can always get in touch with me and I can direct you to the book.
Excellent. And yeah, I'll have all that information as well as with the link to your website on my blog, whatpinksoundslike.com, for anyone who's interested or didn't get a chance to jot down that information. All right. Well, thank you again.
Thanks, Ashley. It was great.
All right. Yeah. Lots more coming up left on What Pink Sounds Like, including my little short concert review of Janelle Monáe's concert at Rogers Arena this past Friday. She was on tour with mega hit wonder Bruno Mars, and it was quite the show, I have to say. So all that more coming up next, but first here's Ostra with Beat and the Pulse.
Ride her duck and horse, the temper's lying told, it's always the same, it's always there. I noticed.
Cumbre presents Times New Viking. The indie lo-fi rockers will be playing on Wednesday, June 22nd at the Media Club, 695 Canby Street, to support their upcoming album, Dancer Required. Doors are at 8 p.m. and tickets are $13, available online at www.ticketweb.ca or from Red Cat, Scratch and Zulu Records.
Party is off to a good start. Guests are on time. Everyone's out to have fun and to help others fun.
What's the matter? Doesn't that sound exciting to you?
UBC students have an alternative. Looking to unwind? Check out one of the sub's two licensed establishments.
Ooh. The Pit Pub and Burger Bar is home of the famous Pit Night. Relax with great prices on cold beer and lots of big screen HD TVs, or chow down on charbroiled burgers, beer battered fish and chips, and Belgian fries. The Pit is open 7 days a week, and Wednesday through Saturday is open late until 2 a.m. This business is owned and operated by the AMS, your student society.
This just in, Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, CITR 101.9 FM presents Cabaret Radio. Join host Teddy Smooth as he explores the chime miracle, the hysterical, the phantasmagorical world of burlesque and cabaret. Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, CITR 101.9 FM brings you Cabaret Radio.
And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Welcome back to What Pink Sounds Like. I'm your host, Ashley Kissman. My hour is almost done, but Oswaldo from the Morning After show, who was on before me from 11:30 to 1, is back on at 2 p.m. for all your listening pleasure. And I heard he's going to carry on the theme of this show, which is all about celebrating women in media and in music, into the next hour, taking over for Linda B. So stay tuned for that. I've had a lot of fun hosting this show. It's always kind of weird being gone for 2 weeks and then getting back on air. As I said, I was a bridesmaid in a wedding, and I went back to Michigan to be a part of that wedding where it took place at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. It was lots of fun. If you want all my little funny anecdotes and epiphanies about being a bridesmaid, just go visit my blog, whatpinksoundslike.com, and it's guaranteed to hopefully brighten up your day. Or if you yourself are going to be in a wedding sometime soon, might have some pretty good tips for you. Like, don't lock your knees, because you will pass out on stage in a pretty dress. It didn't happen to me, but it almost did. So that's my fair warning for you. Before that, we had Ostra with off their album Feel It Break, definitely a really popular album here at CITR, and that was the song Darken Her Horse. And then before that was the lovely Janelle Monáe, one of my favorite artists of 2010, and that was her album The Arc Android, and that was Come Alive. I saw her perform at Rogers Arena with Bruno Mars this past Friday, and it was an amazing show. I admit I bought the tickets more so for Janelle Monáe than Bruno Mars, but Bruno Mars held its own. The difference between the two is Bruno Mars had definitely crafted his show for the tween audience that was there. He was very cocky on stage, very smiley, whereas Janelle Monáe, her performance, be it amazing, I think should have been more suited to a venue like the Commodore. It certainly was very indie, and maybe a little too indie for the 12-year-olds in the audience, but I really enjoyed it. I was jamming along. She even painted a painting on stage. That last song that you just heard, which was Come Alive, when she performed it on stage, it was mad strobe lights everywhere, and everything looks cooler in strobe lights. She was, of course, on stage in her normal tuxedo, no costume changes or anything for the basically female version of James Brown. It was really a great show, so I recommend checking that out. Again, the few pictures I tried to take